And welcome back, Lee Server with us. Lee, somehow, somewhere, Johnny Roselli's name comes up with the JFK assassination. I find that hard to believe, but there's been talk that he was at Dealey Plaza, that he popped out of a sewer and took a shot. What do you think? What have you uncovered? Anything there?
Well, it's very difficult for me to imagine him getting a crease in his handmade suit, you know, kneeling down in that
in a sewer.
But seriously, I can't point to anything that is, to my mind, to my, you know, the level of research I was trying to uphold, that showed it. He would not have been a person to do such a job. Right. I mean,
he might have known about the plot.
That is certainly a possibility. There's no evidence he was a marksman or anything of that sort of a practical level. But I will tell you this, as skeptical as I am, there is an intriguing little point to make, which is that the FBI files on Roselli, the detailed note-taking of where he was, what day, and when he did it, and so forth, for some reason, they end a few days before the assassination.
That's interesting.
And they don't begin again until
after.
2 days after.
Huh.
Now, that could be somehow, I don't know how or why or when, but it could be a hoax or somebody that deliberately tried to obfuscate something by leaving that trail open. I don't know. And I wasn't going to indulge, you know, in the kind of wild speculation. You know, I maybe could sell a few more books if I did it that way.
I get it.
I wanted to say only what I could prove to myself was happening.
He knew Marilyn Monroe. Might he have been involved in her death?
Again, I see no evidence of
it. Right.
He was very, you know, he was friendly with her at a certain point. He may have gotten her one of her first screen breaks at Columbia. He was introduced to her by Joe Skank, who was one of her sort of sugar daddies for a time. He just didn't take that kind of thing. And the whole Monroe thing, to me, is full of a lot of question marks. I know some people pursue that, and I know, you know, there are elements of evidence, but it wasn't enough to convince me, and I didn't want to put it in print if I wasn't convinced.
There have been lots of reports over the years that Roselli tried to shake down some movie moguls in Hollywood. Is that true?
Well, he absolutely was in. There's kind of a series of incidents that involved him. The first was in the 1930s. It was a criminal enterprise was brilliant, but this was brilliant. Johnny, as a liaison in Hollywood, became an inside man in the labor negotiations by the studio. This led one piece at a time to the Chicago mob taking over the talent agency, the IATSE, it was called, the theatrical stage employees, people that moved, you know, things and so forth. They literally took it over by using two frontmen named Beoff and Brown. And these guys then literally with Johnny as a point man in Hollywood and the Chicago outfit under Frank Nitti at that point, they blackmailed the entire motion picture industry. They extorted millions of dollars because if they said there was a strike, if they said nobody goes to work tomorrow, the movie industry closed down, and all of these guys, Louis B. Mayer at MGM and the Warner Brothers and so on, they paid cash money to these Beoff and Brown and these mobsters for fear of being shut down. It was a brilliant thing until it went bad and everybody went to jail.
It's what the mob did in New York at stores, you know, claiming, you know, you need protection, pay me.
Sure. It was that same kind of black hand thing, that same extortion. But this was writ large. This was one of the biggest industries in the world. And it became, when they all went to trial, it was the biggest extortion plot, you know, that was ever tried and convicted.
Why do you think he was killed, Lee? What do you think had happened? Was he skimming out of Vegas? Was it the Fidel Castro situation? Why did he get killed?
You know, the mob has all these rules and regulations, supposedly. You don't do this, you don't do that.
Because I thought he was a golden boy to these
people. He was, but he wasn't anymore. You know, he had outstayed his welcome. Accardo, who took over in Chicago, never liked him. They had a feud going back to the Capone days. Giancana was Johnny's real, you know, close pal. He was his protector. When Giancana went under, and Giancana, you know, had to leave the country, he had to roam around in Mexico and Europe to stay out of the United States. He was finished as a mob boss, and he finally gave up. He didn't want to be boss anymore. But these guys are so worried about somebody trying to get back, trying to take their power, trying to get some of the money they
want to
give them. And Johnny went under, just as Giancana went under. There is another aspect to this, which, you know, may take more time than we have, but Johnny was also involved, although he, to my understanding, he was not a squealer on this case, but the Fed went after these two Detroit mobsters and threw them in jail, and one of them had been set to be the leader of the Detroit mob, and this ruined his whole future plans.
Interesting.
And he was said to be red hot against Roselli, and that it was he who called for a hit on Johnny for revenge. And because nobody in Chicago was left to back him up, they didn't turn it down.
Detroit's my hometown, Lee, and I may probably have been the last reporter, news person, to talk to Jimmy Hoffa before he disappeared.
You know, I heard that story, George, and it sounds fascinating.
And that's another book for you, my gosh. Let's take some calls here. Let's go to Bill, truck driving in the state of Washington. Bill, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, George. Hey, Lee. Hey, I'm a Gen Xer. I'm 50 years old, and I ran into a guy who was a baby boomer. He was older than me, and he adamantly, I mean, he denied that the mafia exists. He even told me that I was a fool. I mean, a whole bunch of insults he gave me, and it really made me feel bad. And then I found out, you know, I questioned some people about it, and they said, you know, there used to be a lot of those people that kind of denied the mafia existed. Yeah. And, you know, I was, you know, and with the gap between the rich and the poor, you know, becoming more extreme, and the fact that the rich used to be taxed a lot more, you know, than they are now, It kind of led me to this theory that maybe these guys that deny the mafia exists, you know, believe that taxing, like he kept saying, the mafia was nothing more than a family business that the government hated. Could it be that they just believe that taxing by the government is immoral, so that way they don't believe that something so obvious like the mafia exists? Have you ever met anyone like that?
Well, that's, you know, an interesting theory. I may actually believe in it myself, but that's another story. The fact is that mob in the way that I'm talking about it, which was really a phenomenon of the 20th century. It began in the early parts of the century in connection with the great immigrant movements into the big cities in America. And, you know, there was first the Black Hand and so forth. And it's very complicated and detailed. I go into a lot of it in the book. So I try to show how they went from, in the period of Prohibition and in the 1930s, they went from what was kind of a mom-and-pop operation in terms of the mob, and how they grew into this nationwide thing. People like Lucky Luciano and Meyer Lansky, they had this idea of an interconnected underworld of literally organized crime that could stretch, you know, across the country, and that people would be, the mobsters would be in different factions, different families that once only tended their own garden, now were in a way interconnected and could make bigger and bigger scams and take over larger pieces of you know, national product, make more money. A lot of this had a rise and fall, and a lot of the big families that once thrived and ran so much of the American underworld have gone now. They're as gone as anything that's disappeared, like a dial telephone. You know, they're a thing of the 20th century. Other mobs have come in using a lot of their same innovations and so forth. You know, we have South American mobs, and we have
Russian mobsters.
Mobs, yeah. And, you know, so a lot of that classic, what we think of as, you know, the classic Italian-American and Jewish and a couple of other ethnicities that formed the syndicate in the 1920s and 30s, that was really a period. There are certainly remnants of it, but they were quite a remarkable industry for
it. It was a huge organization, wasn't it?
Absolutely. You know, when you added them together and when they interacted and so forth, you know, I mean, it was a remarkable period. Whatever you think of the mob, they really made some remarkable moves in the society. I mean, just look at Las Vegas. That was pretty much their idea. They built it. And, you know, and the people came.
And they're still coming there.
Although, you know, and I'm sure there are still, you know, parts that link back to those old days, although there have been certainly major changes from the 60s and 50s.
Let's go to Joe in the Bronx. Hey, Joe, go ahead.
George, how are you?
All right, Joe. Thank you.
Good. Yeah, Lee, I wanted to ask you about Johnny Roselli's association with Frank Sinatra. How close were they, and were they ever at odds?
Were they at odds? You know, I really don't think so. I mean, I was talking before about, you know, Frank taking away Johnny's partner, and these guys, you know, Frank Costello was and others, they so loved Frank Sinatra that he really could do no wrong,
and he loved them, didn't he?
Sure, you know, they you know, scrubbed each other's back. There are a couple of funny, you know, sequences in the book where you see Sam Giancana getting fed up with Sinatra, and Sinatra's always kind of like being obsequious to him, and, you know, kind of almost, you know, and they start making fun of him as if he was almost like a little, you know, starry-eyed girl wanting to be in Giancana's company. But as much as they could get fed up with him, and they did get very fed up with him in the Kennedy period, because Sinatra had basically made promises that he could not collect on.
Didn't some mobsters at the time, Lee, think about rubbing him out?
You know, Giancana supposedly said it once, and then he says, you know, Then I put on one of his records.
I had a soft feeling for it.
Yeah.
But he thought about it. I think they were going to do something.
I think Giancana probably thought about it with almost everyone he met.
Well, and Kennedy turned on Frank because, you know, once he got elected, the brother Bobby kept saying, look, you know, Frank's associating with some of these mobsters. We don't want anything to do with them. They kind of backed off him, and it really upset Sinatra.
Yeah, and let me tell you, George, I have a thing in there that I uncovered. As far as I know, it was never printed anywhere previously. It comes from a hearing, a transcript, you know, under oath. And there was a man, he was a Washington police detective. He also was a liaison at the White House for security. And he was very connected with both the mob and the FBI, not in a nefarious way with the mob, but he was simply a kind of a hanger-on. And he, in there telling this story that I found in this transcript, that according to him, Hoover had played some surreptitious recordings from Giancana's phone or from his headquarters. And Sinatra is talking to Giancana, who by then was fed up with the way the Kennedys, after they had helped them with the election, they weren't paying back what they promised.
Yeah, they didn't back off either.
Yeah, and through this conversation, it becomes apparent that Frank Sinatra was having an affair with President Kennedy's sister, Pat, who was at the time married to
Peter Lawford. That's right.
They were having an affair, and Sinatra says on this tape to Giancana, I'm working on her, you know, and other words to that effect. I'm going to get her to talk to the big man, and you're going to, you know, you'll see results. And Hoover played this tape for Bobby Kennedy. And Ken and Bobby went through the roof.
I'm nuts, yeah.
He ran down to his brother and said, Sinatra is out. And let me just say, the story has been told many times that it was because of Sinatra's associations. But the fact was that Sinatra associations had been in the news for many years. So when I saw this story, it rang, you know, a bell because... Really, the traditional story about cutting Sinatra out of the Kennedy White House for good really made a lot more sense with this much more personal and kind of crass story.
Makes sense. Lee, stay with us. We're going to come back in a moment here on Coast to Coast AM and take final phone calls as we talk about his incredible work on Johnny Roselli. Handsome Johnny, next. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Lee Server with us. Lee, of course, is the author of several books, including, of course, Handsome Johnny, which we're talking about. We'll take your calls as well. How did you end up writing about Ava Gardner, Lee?
You know, the first kind of big biography I'd done was on Robert Mitchum, who was about as colorful a character as you could find. And I wanted to find somebody that was equally colorful, exciting, and I started thinking about Ava, and I started researching a little, and she was fantastic, colorful character, roamed around the world, and broke Frank Sinatra's heart, I think I got much more than I even anticipated. She was quite a fascinating character.
She sure was, and they always say that was the one he truly loved.
That's right.
Let's go to the final phone calls. Mike's in Cleveland, Ohio. Welcome to the show, Michael. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning, George. Good morning, Lee.
Morning.
Lee, I was going to ask you if you thought a plausible theory for the death of Jimmy Hoffa would have been that he was getting involved with the UAW, Johnny Roselli and the CIA took care of that. And if that's what puts the puzzle together with your gentleman from Detroit, a friend of mine's father was really involved with Jimmy in those years. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the direction he was going to go, was with the UAW.
And about that theory. It's a fascinating case, and I can't say that I researched, you know, where the Hoffa story goes, you know, takes a turn, and there was a lot, kind of similar to what I was saying about Giancana, where Hoffa came back and people said, well, your time is over, and he thought, you know, his time wasn't over, you know, they decided they would have to make that decision.
He wanted to come back and run for the presidency. Now, his parole terms were he could not, but he was going to fight that. And you're right. What he had done when he left office, he kind of handed the presidency to Frank Fitzsimmons, who was his vice president. And Frank would acquiesce to anything the mob wanted. Whatever they wanted, he opened up the Teamster pension fund. They could do whatever they wanted. Yeah. Jimmy, whenever he lent money out of that, made money for the fund. He didn't lose any money in those deals.
That's absolutely true. I mentioned that in the book. That and Hoffa, you know, wanted the mob to kind of tell people that they had made money with him, and he had made money from them, because otherwise it made it look like he had squandered them.
That's right, and he did not. He made a good return for the Teamsters pension fund. But he wanted to run again, and the mob had a deal with Frank Fitzsimmons. They didn't want that changed.
Yeah, and they have one way of settling their differences like that.
Exactly. Let's go next to Mike in Vancouver, British Columbia. Welcome to the program. Hi, Michael.
Hi, George. Hi, Lee.
Hi.
Relative... actually fought in World War II, Italian from Sicily, and he was brought on through the special correspondence with Patton, and took the 7th Army into the docks in Sicily. Now, Trafficante, Luciano, Cardo, and Giacondo were all Sicilians, and essentially... that's why Patton was brought back to Great Britain before Normandy, because he was going to move up to Berlin. And the deal with allies with the Russians was that they would leave Berlin for the Russians. The difficulty becomes, and the reason why they use Patton as bait is because Rommel hated him. And Patton had beaten Rommel, and Montgomery had beaten Rommel in North Africa. So Rommel wanted to take him out. And he had such a hate on, they knew he'd be the perfect bait. Capone... with the St. Valentine's Massacre, took control of Chicago, and hence the outfit, which was the original name for all the Sicilians. And it gets pretty dicey from there on in, because, of course, Patton becomes a general under Eisenhower, appointed after Normandy, and he mysteriously dies, breaking his neck, falling off the back seat of his army chauffeur-driven limousine. And it goes on from there. Kennedy would enter, Joe Sr. would enter, in the sense that he knew this stuff from the stock market, which the Sicilians were into. And, of course, Joe Kennedy Sr. rewrote all the SEC rules and betrayed all his buddies that worked with him on the stock exchange. And it goes on from there.
Yeah. Well, there's certainly a lot of deep roots to a lot of these things. And the whole story of the mobsters that, particularly like Luciano, who had been in prison on a prostitution rap, where they, you know, they had kind of put him away for good, and the government came to him and asked him to help them out, both, you know, through his connections with the docks and with the Sicilians. You know, war and other things make strange bedfellows. You know, we see a lot of this in the headlines now, but they were doing it then, and it gets very deep and very complicated.
Lee, if Johnny Roselli were still alive today and you were interviewing him for the book, what would you be asking him?
Who put you in that barrel, Johnny?
He'd say, what
barrel?
It's
difficult questions, but, you know.
You probably have your own suspicions who put him in that barrel, huh?
You know, I think it was a mob hit. I think it was asked for by one of several people who had it out for him. And I think the big guy in Chicago just disliked him enough and wanted to be clean of clean sweep of the Giancana bunch that had ruled mm-hmm. in the 50s and 60s. And it didn't hurt to say, Johnny is being hauled into Washington. Who knows what he's going to say next?
Right.
It was just a moment in time that wasn't good for Johnny. And, you know, he used to say to people when they warned him that there were rumors and people talking bad about, and he said, you know, I'm an old man now. I'm retired. Who's going to hurt me? And he got it wrong.
Yeah, he sure did. And do you think they killed him in L.A. and shipped his body to Florida? Or what was he doing down there?
You know, he was in so much trouble. He'd spent so much money on lawyers. He'd gotten out of prison. It nearly killed him. He was in his 70s. He finally, whole other stories about how they proved that he was an illegal immigrant, didn't have citizenship. In any case, he still had to fight these legal battles with the government. He went and lived with his sister and her husband down in their house in a quiet neighborhood in Florida. And he thought, okay, I'm just going to be a retired old guy sitting by the pool, you know, and reading a paperback. I'm out of it. And but sometimes your past catches up with you.
All right, let's go to Joe, Long Island, New York. Hey, Joseph, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Lee. I think it would be out of character. You know, this guy's hanging out with lots of women, Ava Gardner. I don't think he would have cared that much about losing the gigs in Havana. I don't think that would have set him off.
Would have set who off?
Johnny. I don't think the mob was that upset about losing their...
They were furious, Joe. They were furious.
Yeah, they lost millions of dollars. Johnny himself didn't, but, you know, he was involved really for his own reason, but it was the CIA that thought that would be the motivating factor. They never, you know, that they had lost all this money and wanted to get back and get their casinos back, but they never... had not counted on Johnny simply doing it for no pay and saying it was his patriotic duty.
And Johnny was a foot soldier, wasn't he? Or was he more than that?
You mean in the mob?
For the mob, yeah.
Yeah, I think he was a little bit of everything. He was much more than that. He was a very distinct kind of gangster. You know, we see all the cliches of the guy sitting in the back of the meat market and these guys kind of sloppy and D's and D's kind of guys. And he didn't have a gang. He didn't have protection in that kind of way. He roamed free. He was a kind of, have gun, will travel kind of guy. And he liked it that way. He was an adventurer.
Where does a guy like that get his weekly paycheck?
It depended on the period, but during the Vegas period, for instance, he got his piece of the skim for all the work that he did, and they were bringing in millions and millions of dollars, and everybody, you know, wet their beak, and he was doing fine. He had all kinds of business interests. Some of them were legit, and, we didn't even get into when he became a movie producer and made two successful and well-regarded movies, but he had a little bit of everything. But most of it went through years of paying off lawyers for all of these trials. You know, that's another way
that's
that the government gets them.
Let's go to Anthony in Los Angeles. Take it away, Anthony.
Hey, how you doing, George?
Okay.
How you doing? I mean, this is a great show.
Thank you.
I'm a first-time caller, long, long-time listener, and this subject is just, it's right up my alley, you guys.
I love it. Fascinating, isn't it?
It's more than fascinating. I'm not here to promote myself. I work with a startup that we actually work with mobsters and former mobsters and family of mobsters.
Really? I mean, what do you do? Tell me.
Well, we help them a number of different ways. Some of them want to be speakers. Some of them want to, you know, help in the film industry as SMEs. Others are writers, and some of them are, you know, from some really, you know, mobsters that you mentioned tonight. And it's a new startup that we decided that we would put together. I guess you could say it's a plan sort of to help bring these guys together and, you know, to allow them to speak to the
do their
public.
Thing. Give them a new life, I guess, too.
Well, it's very commendable, and it's probably all for the best. You know, if you go through this book of mine, you will see that a great majority of the characters end up shot, strangled, hung, electrocuted, shot again, thrown in a barrel, and it doesn't have a real good insurance plan.
If the mob in the 50s and 60s, if you could say, was 100% complete, where would it be today, Lee? What percent would you say the mob was at in terms of a viable running organization?
Well, you know, at their peak, they were really, they had moved so far into normal society, businesses, unions, resorts, and so forth. There's no telling, you know, how far it might have gone if a few things hadn't just started to turn against them.
Danny is with us in San Bruno, California, real fast. Danny, go ahead.
Hey, George. It's Schrodinger's cat here, abandoned cat, giving a call.
Hi there.
Hey, listen, friend of mine out here in San Bruno at Carol's Meats makes my sandwiches, and he told me this cute anecdote. I wanted to share it with you.
Sure.
The guy comes, he tells me, he's got a friend in Vegas that knows Frank Sinatra, you know, years back.
Ooh.
And so his friend sees another one of his friends at a table where Sinatra's at, right? Big hotel. And he says, hey, Frank, can you do me a favor and go up and say hello to my friend right there with his girlfriend? So Frank goes up to the table and he says, hey, how are you guys doing this evening? I'm Frank Sinatra. You guys having a nice evening? And the guy at the table says, Frank, can't you see I'm here with my girlfriend?
I love that joke. That's a Rickles story. You know that. Don Rickles had that joke a long time ago. Lee, did you ever hear it?
Yeah.
I love it.
It works.
So with a minute left, my friend, where do people get your book, Handsome Johnny?
You can go to Amazon. You can go to Barnes & Noble. Pretty much all places you buy books. And I hope everybody gives it a try. I think you'll enjoy it. A lot of this stuff is complicated. And I hope I made it clear, but the book lays it out very slowly and carefully.
What are you working on next?
I've got a couple of things I'm trying to decide, and I will, you know, get back to you very soon.
Absolutely. We'd love to have you back on. Thank you so much for being on the show, Lee.
Thank you, George. I really appreciate it.
Fantastic interview about Johnny Roselli. Handsome Johnny. It's an amazing piece of history, my friends. Just an amazing piece of history. Lots going on for the rest of the week. And don't forget, this weekend we'll be live in Everett, Washington with our live stage show at the historic Everett Theater. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, Tim Banal, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.